Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event with Peter Grester. As most of you know, Peter was arrested in Cairo in December 2013, along with his two Al Jazeera colleagues, Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed, for doing their jobs as journalists in the aftermath of the military coup in Egypt. The charges levied against them included allegations of spreading false news and aiding a terrorist group otherwise known as the Muslim Brotherhood, or Egypt's previous ruling party. Peter and his colleagues were convicted and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. But in February this year, following sustained diplomatic efforts by the Australian and other governments, Peter was deported, having spent 400 days in three different Egyptian prisons. Peter is still facing criminal charges alongside Fahmy and Mohamed in an ongoing trial in Egypt, which resumes today. Peter, let me start by saying once again, welcome home. I know it's belated now and you've had more welcomes probably than Dame Nellie Melba when she'd return, but all of us here at Bligh Street were really delighted and relieved when we got the news that you'd been freed and we saw that tweet of you on the beach in Cyprus. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Grester. Just before I hand over to Peter and Anthony, let me say a couple of words about a related issue, and that is the Institute's work to encourage journalism by Australians like Peter Grester covering international issues. Our aim here at the Institute is to deepen the international policy debate in Australia, and part of that means ensuring that we have Australian eyes on the world, that we have Australian journalists out there reporting for Australian audiences on what is happening in the world, as outstanding Australian journalists. It's not good enough for us as Australians to be getting all our news from CNN or Time magazine or other international news organisations. And one thing we have done as an institute in the past couple of years to encourage Australian eyes on the world is to introduce the annual Lowy Institute Media Award, which recognises reporting or commentary which has deepened the knowledge or shaped the discussion of international policy issues in Australia. Last year, in 2014, the award was given to Hayden Cooper for his ABC foreign correspondent report on Peter's trial at a dinner in this very room, and I well remember Andrew Grester being here for it. And today, I'm delighted to announce that IAG has agreed to sponsor the 2015 Media Award, which will be awarded during a dinner with Robert Thompson, who's the Australian journalist, former foreign correspondent for the Financial Times, and former editor of both the Wall Street Journal and the London Times, who's now the CEO of News Corp, on the 13th of August. Ladies and gentlemen, enough of the ad. Let me introduce Peter and Anthony. Peter is an award-winning journalist and correspondent who's worked for a number of news organisations, including Reuters, the BBC and Al Jazeera's English News Channel. He started out reporting on Bosnia and South Africa, then moved on to cover Afghanistan, Latin America and the Middle East. He was the BBC's Kabul correspondent in 1995 and returned after the invasion in 2001. Since 2009, he's principally been based in Nairobi, from where he has covered East Africa with a particular focus on Somalia. He's won many prestigious prizes, including the Peabody Award and a Walkley Award. Peter will be talking today with Anthony Bubalo. He's known to many of you. Anthony is our research director at the Institute. He directs all of the Institute's research program, but in his spare time, he's one of Australia's leading analysts on the Middle East. He served as a diplomat, in fact, in Cairo, and he and I were in Cairo together a few months ago. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very much looking forward to this discussion. Let me hand over to Anthony Bubalo.
Thanks, Michael. Peter, whenever we have one of these conversations, it's usual to say to the guest, well, it's great to see you here. But in this case, it really is great to see you here. When we look at cases like this, a lot of the detail gets lost. And so I wanted to start really at the beginning. So take us back to that time when you flew into Cairo, of course, to do some relief work for Al Jazeera. What happened?
Well, I'd only been in Cairo for a couple of weeks. As Michael mentioned, I was my main job is in East Africa, covering the region, the East African region. sub-Saharan region for the BBC and Al Jazeera. And so I'd been asked just to do some bureau cover for a couple of weeks, for 2 or 3 weeks. I don't know much about Egypt. That was, in fact, my first ever visit to Egypt. And so what we were doing was very much treading water. It was all fairly, I have to admit, it was fairly mundane journalism. You know, we had a political crisis that was unfolding. You remember that the Muslim Brotherhood had been the first elected government that Egypt had ever had in the middle of 2012. By the middle of 2013, they'd been ousted. And we were still in the middle of that transition phase. There was a transitional government that was supposed to oversee elections at that point. And so there was a lot of pressure on the Muslim Brotherhood. They were under enormous pressure from the officials, from the government. What I was trying to do was cover that story with as much balance as I could manage. I wasn't trying to break any new ground with this. I wasn't trying to push any boundaries. My radar wasn't tuned into anything, but wasn't tuned into the Egyptian political scene at that point. I'm more than happy. I've been prepared to upset a few governments in the past when I've known what the limits are and what the likely response might be, and I've understood the political environment much more. In Egypt's case, because I was so new, I really wasn't interested in pushing boundaries. I just wanted to get through the stories on a daily basis to do the best possible job that I could to keep the stories balanced, basically just to tread water and keep our coverage alive. And we knew that we'd had a difficult relationship with the authorities, that Al Jazeera had a difficult relationship with the authorities. We weren't pushing the boundaries in the public sphere either. But I had absolutely no idea, I tell you, when I finally got a knock on the door at the hotel, the Marriott, on the night of the 28th of December in 2013. I was about ready to go out, just to go out and have dinner with a friend of mine, and there was this knock on the door, and I thought this was a bit strange. It was about 8 o'clock at night. And I remember thinking it was a bit odd, and I thought, well, perhaps there's some message from the hotel staff, perhaps it was someone else from Al Jazeera who'd wanted me for something. I couldn't understand why they hadn't called, and I was a bit slow getting to the door, and there was a slightly more urgent pounding, and I thought, again, a bit odd, and then came a fist pounding at the door. I opened the door up. I didn't bother checking through the peephole, and the door burst open, and a whole bunch of guys flooded in. And to this day, I don't know how many of them there were. I reckon it felt like about 6 or 8. I just seemed to fill the room, started rifling through it. They didn't tell me who they were, what they wanted, but started picking up all sorts of bits of equipment and throwing them in a bag.
And then, were Bahad Muhammad and Muhammad Fahmy arrested at the same time?
Yeah, they were. Fahmy, I was taken down after I was detained, and after they'd seized the equipment, been through my room, they took me down. There's a police room in the lower floor, the ground floor of the hotel, and so I was taken there, and I was basically ordered to stay. And I, again, had no idea what was going on. Remember, I don't speak Arabic. I was working through translators at that point, and they rather conveniently didn't speak English, so I had no understanding of what on earth was going on, no way of really communicating. And then after about half an hour, I guess 45 minutes, they came down with Fahmy, and I realized that this was turning into something quite significant. Beha was at his home when they raided that.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that initially you guys thought, all right, we're in some trouble here, but it's probably going to blow over. They're trying to place some pressure on Al Jazeera. At what point did it become very clear in this process that this was actually far more serious than that?
I think everybody thought that because there was no basis to the allegations. I mean, let me say this. We didn't know what the specifics of the allegations were until until we were taken to court, and that was about 3 or 4 weeks in. We knew, I started to get a sense of what was going on during the questioning period, during the interrogations, because the questions were very pointed about our association with the Muslim Brotherhood, about alleged contacts that we'd had with them, about whether we'd brought in money for the Brotherhood and so on. And that started to ring some quite serious alarm bells, but it wasn't until we learnt the charges that were against us, we realised that this was actually a lot more serious than we'd initially felt.
And what were the charges?
We're charged with supporting a terrorist organisation, financing a terrorist organisation, broadcasting false news to undermine national security, but in a number of other related charges. But those are the key ones.
So you find yourself in this trial, and obviously, particularly for those of us that are not familiar with an Egyptian court scene, you know, it's that famous scene of you in the prison outfit, you know, behind these cells in the courtroom. And, you know, I know from my own time in Egypt, it's a scene reminiscent of you know, terrorism trials, of trials of kind of political activists. So the imagery is very, very kind of pregnant with meaning. I mean, how did that feel? I mean, you must have felt, you know, a few weeks ago you're reporting on North Africa, and now you're in this cage in the Egyptian court.
Well, again, that was another stage in the evolution of this thing. That was when we were brought into that courtroom. That courtroom is very explicitly designed for terrorism cases. That's why they have the cage there. I mean, it's partly to restrain or defend or keep the court safe from what they would regard as very, very dangerous, the most dangerous prisoners that they have in the system. But it's also a way of sending a very clear message to everyone watching it that we consider these people to be extremely dangerous. And so to be behind that cage, looking out across the cage, because that was also one of the few opportunities that we had to see anybody. And I could see my family. My family came once the trial started. My brothers started coming, and they were always in court. And we could see them across, sitting, our family sitting across the court. That was quite tough. I mean, you know, the idea of being literally a caged animal, a caged prisoner, was very confronting. Although I have to tell you that after a while, we found the prison conditions, they weren't necessarily odious, they were extremely, at points, excruciatingly constrictive, restraining. And so we started to look forward to the trials, if only because it became a day out.
The court case proceeds. The judge says guilty, 7 years. Take us through your feelings at that point.
Yeah, that wasn't a good day. You know, anyone who watched the trial, anyone who saw the evidence that was presented, recognized that there was no evidence that we'd done anything wrong. There wasn't even... I always expected to have to defend my journalism. I always expected to have to defend the reasons that we'd chosen to make certain interviews or use a certain choice of words or chose the pictures that we chose to illustrate the stories. And I was quite prepared to do that. There was, you know, ethically, there was nothing wrong. We'd broken no ethical boundaries, and I was perfectly comfortable with the work that we'd done. But I always expected to have to be confronted by that. And when even that didn't come up, we felt that, well, there simply isn't anything there that they could possibly convict us on. And so we felt that, at the very most, they might get us on some administrative charge to at least appear... that we to give the appearance of fault to justify what we'd been through, but we thought that at the very most we'd get sentenced to time served. We'd already spent about 6 months in prison at that point, and you know, given the kinds of charges, the administrative charges that we were facing, that alone would have been a fairly heavy sentence. And when we heard that not only had been we been convicted, but sentenced to 7 years, I promise you, it felt like we'd been king hit by Mike Tyson. Everyone says that a lot of the media coverage that I've seen since speaks about the uproar, that the noise that erupted in the courtroom as people started shouting and other people started, you know, crying and so on. Honestly, I don't remember anything. I just remember silence. I didn't hear a thing. It was devastating in the extreme.
So you're now entering prison. You know, you're incarcerated in Tora prison, as we talked about a little bit before. It's actually three separate prisons within the kind of Tora complex, but it's the most notorious prison complex in Egypt. It's where, you know, kind of enemies of the regime, terrorists, have all been held in that prison complex still today. How do you adjust to life in that prison complex? Even as you hold out hope that with all the efforts going on outside that you will get released, that you won't serve your 7 years. How did you adjust to life in prison?
One of the things that you realise very quickly is that the greatest danger in prison, and I wager that that's here as much as anywhere else, is your own mind. The whole point of prison, I've spoken to a couple of people who've been through some pretty extreme circumstances, and even if you're being physically abused, the point about prison is to mess with your head. And what we were facing, particularly in the early stages of the first couple of weeks, I was in solitary confinement. And the greatest danger is your own mind starting to eat itself up. You've got this vast space, this open lump of time in front of you, this unformed blob of time. And you have to do something with it. If you don't do something with it, your mind starts to dig up all sorts of demons. And so I realized after a while, and I saw too what it had done, what it was doing to a couple of other people who didn't seem to have the tools to deal with it particularly well, and they were a real mess. And so we realized that you have to look after three things: your physical health, your mental health, and your spiritual health, mind, body, spirit. I feel a little bit nervous sometimes about sounding like some kind of self-help guru, but it really is that simple. And for us, that meant exercising daily. The Australian High Commission, the embassy, the consular staff, when they came, they brought in a 5BX program that they'd printed out. I don't know if any of you know 5BX, but it's 5 basic exercises. It's a program that apparently was designed by the Canadian Air Force to give their airmen, so that if they're ever downed in World War II and kept as POWs, they'd be able to keep fit. As long as you have enough space, physical space, to lie down, to do some press-ups, sit-ups, and a couple of other exercise, you can keep yourself pretty fit. And so that became a part of the daily routine. We would also go through a lot of mind games, memory games, a lot of creative games. Sometimes we'd get food brought in covered with tin foil, and we kept all of the tin foil, and we realized that if you cover the back of the tin foil with soap, it sticks very well to the concrete wall. And so I made a big sun on the wall of the cell. We sort of tore up the strips and we kept them, and we made this huge sun, and we kind of created murals out of the tin foil. Just again, to be as much to be creative and mentally active as anything else. And the third thing was meditation. It's a question of keeping things in perspective. And for me, I went through a bit of a personal crisis a few years ago. And just to try and steady the ship, I went and did a meditation course. And that turned out to be hugely important, because every day I would make sure that I had a couple of hours of the meditation, again, to try and make sure and understand what my head was doing, not to try and suppress the kinds of emotions, but to process them and make sure that I didn't allow my own head to eat itself up.
Now, while you're in jail, you have, you know, the campaign to secure your release and those of your colleagues gears up. You've got some pretty heavyweight figures around the world getting involved in that campaign. The Australian Prime Minister, the Australian Foreign Minister, the embassy there is very active. You have no one less than President Obama, fighting your corner with the Egyptians. But you had a secret weapon as well, which was the Latvian government. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I discovered while I was in prison that I'm actually a dual national. I didn't realize this. The Latvians were extraordinary. As I said, I had no idea that I was a Latvian national before this.
But you're a proud one today.
I'm a very proud one today. I read about it in the newspaper. I'm not kidding, someone smuggled in an article, a newspaper article, which from Australia, I've forgotten which one it was now, but I was reading it, it described me as Australian Latvian dual national. And it quoted the Latvian embassy here. And I thought, what's going on? How did this happen? What happened was that back in 1992, 93, I think, when the Soviet Union broke up and Latvia got its independence, it was very keen about hoovering up as much of the diaspora as it could. It's only a tiny country with a couple of million people, or 3 million people in Latvia. And so my father, of course, was a refugee from Latvia. He was born in Latvia. And I went along to the Latvian embassy and duly registered my patriality. At that point, the Latvian passport was pretty much worthless. It was only recognized by a couple of other ex-Soviet states. And I never went through I never formalized the process. But it seems that the simple act of registering my father's patriality was enough to put me in the system. There was a number associated with my name in there. And someone from the foreign ministry, a lady called Baiba Braza, who is an extraordinary lady, she saw the reports and she thought, that name sounds Latvian. And she called the Interior Ministry and said, look, can you possibly check this out to see if this guy has any roots with us or any connections to us? And so they dug it, they looked and they came out and said, yes, he's registered with us as having Latvian patriality.
Which is as a former Australian diplomat, I can say, we don't actively go out and seek consulate cases. So it's a kind of a... They come to you, you don't usually go to them, but anyway.
What's more was they actually came and they issued me a passport while I was in prison. You know how everybody says that their prison, their passport photograph looks like a mugshot? Mine really was. I remember one extraordinary day when they came into the prison with... she came in and she had about three or four minders, minions behind her, all lugging the laptop and the camera and the thumbprint scan and all this kit into the prison, in the prison offices to... take all of the biometric stuff from me and take the photograph and issue me with a passport in prison. So I'm very proud of that.
But there was a serious side to it because they had the EU presidency at that time, right?
They took over the presidency on the 1st of January this year. It was a 6-month presidency, so it was right at the very end of it. But it was still very, very important because they did mobilise the European Union. They got first it was Baroness Catherine Ashton, who was the foreign policy chief through last year, and then Mogherini, the Italian lady who's now the current foreign policy chief. And the Latvians worked very, very enthusiastically. And in fact, to their credit, the Latvians and the Australian and DFAT, and the embassy under Ralph King, were extremely... were extremely strong in working together to coordinate the work, coordinate the messages, to make sure that they were working very, very closely together. I'm very proud of that. I think it's a very good effort.
So you've told us about the moment when, how you felt that moment when the judge says, you've got 7 years. Tell us about the moment when you heard that you're about to be released.
That was another surreal moment. I had absolutely no idea that it was coming, none whatsoever. In fact, I went out that morning fully expecting to spend the next... not that I went out expecting to spend the next 7 years, but I realised at that point that we'd run out of options, both legal and political, to be released early. Our convictions were overturned on the 1st of January. The Court of Cassation had 30 days to issue its judgment and appoint a new court to hear our case. We're on the 31st, on the 1st of February on that day, which was 32 days, obviously, after the Court of Cassation had issued its initial verdict, and we still hadn't had anything from the court. There was also the January 25th anniversary, where President Sisi had indicated that he would make a number of pardons, and including a number of journalists. And so there was a lot of speculation that we would be amongst those. But you recall that the week before, I think it was about the 20th or something, King Abdullah died, and the Egyptians declared 7 days of national mourning, and suspended the January 25th celebrations. And just before that period of mourning was due to end, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, one of the main extremist movements in the Sinai Peninsula, launched a series of attacks on some police stations and killed about 25 police officers. And so we realized then that there was no way that the Egyptian government was going to make any pardons. And so, again, we're at this point where we thought, look, we're in clear blue water. That nothing is going to happen. And so I went out fully. I was going to talk to my brother, who was due to visit that day, about some much more serious, about stepping up the campaign, about doing some much more dramatic action to try and apply pressure to keep people on message. And so when I got called out, I used to go running. We had a corridor outside the prison cell. It was about 30 meters long. They wouldn't let us outside of that, but at least they'd open the door to the cell and I could run up and down the corridor. And I'd pound up and down the corridor for about half an hour, 40 minutes, 45 minutes every day, again, partly to keep fit. And I was in the middle of that run when one of the prison guards called me over and said, look, the boss needs to speak to you. And I said, well, what now? Can I not finish? He said, no, now. And I went to see the guy who's known as the chief investigations officer, who is the guy in charge of security. And he said, yeah, pack your stuff. I've got some news. You're going. So what do you mean I'm going? I said, you're moving me to another prison. He said, no. The embassy's here in half an hour. Get going. Yella. And it was completely bizarre. I had 30 minutes to get all my stuff together. Not that there was a whole lot of stuff to get together. But
it's like mural down from the wall, the alpha mural.
And also say goodbye to my colleagues. And it was a really strange moment because, as I said, there'd been no build-up to this. There was no period of preparation for it. It was just pack your stuff, you're going. And so there was a mix of elation at being out, disbelief as to whether or not it was really happening, but also real deep concern from my colleagues who I knew I was leaving behind, and to what at that point was a very uncertain fate.
You're out, but you're not free. In fact, you're still on trial in Egypt, and the trial resumes tomorrow. I mean, tell us about your legal circumstances now.
Yeah, this is rather frustrating. As you said, I'm still on trial, and formally now it looks as though I'm on trial in absentia. We've been trying to, up until recently, my lawyer has been present and allowed to make submissions on my behalf, and we felt that that may have indicated that for the purposes of the trial, the judge had considered me as legally present, legally represented. When I was released, we all thought, I think as most of you probably did, that that was the end of it, that I'd been taken off the case, the charges had been dropped. I was as surprised as anybody when my name appeared as a defendant, and I continued to be on trial. What happens now is because of the legal catch-22 that I'm in, I was deported on an executive order, and so I can't go back without violating that executive order, and yet the judge is demanding that I be there for the trial. My solution was to offer evidence by video link. It's a creative solution that's never been done before in Egypt, and it would have involved breaking new ground, but equally, my legal position has never been anticipated under Egyptian law, and so we've been trying to find, we thought that that would have been a suitable way that would allow the court to see justice done, to give me an opportunity to defend myself and my colleagues and the higher principals as well that we came to represent, and effectively allow the court to allow justice to be done. That hasn't been accepted, and so it looks as though tomorrow is the last day for defence submissions, the last hearing we will have before a verdict. It seems inevitable now that I won't be represented. The judge won't allow my lawyer to make any submissions on my behalf. I have to be legally present. I'm not. And so inevitably it seems as though it appears inevitable that I'll wind up with a conviction. It's less certain, obviously, for my colleagues. I'm still very concerned about their situation. And, of course, their situation, if we do get convictions, are far more serious than mine. They'll have to carry the consequences of any sentence if we do get convicted. But, at the moment, that's the situation.
But there are serious consequences for you as well. It basically means you can't travel to a whole swathe of countries that have extradition treaties with Egypt, including countries that you might want to work in the future.
Yeah, and this is... It means, at a personal level, it is very serious. I mean, I'm a foreign correspondent, it's what I do. But this would rule out, then, travel to any country that has an extradition treaty with Egypt. So that would be most of the Middle East, most of the African Union, most of quite a few countries in Asia, Latin America, and so on. Not too many countries in Europe. Switzerland, I think, has an extradition treaty with Egypt. But it means that my stock in trade is going to be a real problem for me. And obviously it means I would also carry a criminal conviction. I have a criminal record. And I have real headaches getting into the United States, even though the president... I had meetings at the White House. I had meetings with the State Department. I had meetings with Ban Ki-moon. I still have to fill in that form, the answer form. I don't know if any of you have been to the States and ask a series of questions. One of those questions is, have you ever been arrested? And if you check that box, you have to then explain the circumstances of the arrest, and I have to type in, I was arrested and charged with aiding a terrorist organization, financing a terrorist organization, and in brackets, but it was all a load of rubbish.
It may add another week or so to your visa process. But
yeah, it slowed things down a bit. And we had to, I remember, we had a quiet word with the American Embassy in London when I realized this was going to be a problem. And we called them up and said, listen, what do you guys think? And they just went, oh, shit. we managed to get it solved. But the point is that this is always, it's going to throw up all sorts of problems. As you all know, if you need a bank loan, if you want insurance, if you're going to go for certain jobs, you have to declare a criminal record. And although, in practical terms, everyone recognizes that is unlikely to recognize it, I still have that hanging over my head. But let me say, and I really want to emphasize this, for me this is serious, but it is, in my view, this is also about what a conviction would mean for the higher principles involved. Remember, we were supported by hundreds of thousands of our professional colleagues around the world, by politicians and diplomats around the world, up to and including President Obama, Tony Abbott, the government here, Ban Ki-moon, the European Union. I mean, everybody supported us. And literally millions of ordinary people around the world. The Free AJ Staff hashtag received almost 3 billion impressions. 3 billion with a B. That tells you just how much support we had. And part of it was due to what we were going through and the consequences of this for us as individuals. But I think a lot of this was because of what our case came to represent. And those are the higher principles that I mentioned before, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, rule of law, and so on. And so my view is that this is, while obviously I'm concerned about myself and very concerned for my colleagues, we also need to make sure that we don't give up, that a conviction would be a repudiation of everything that all of those people fought for.
I mean, and obviously, you know, it's banal to say it, this is a life-changing moment for you. Whatever happens next, you're not going to be an ordinary journalist anymore. But there are two aspects to your life going forward. There is the professional, you know, continuing to work as a working journalist, but obviously, you know, how also there is a vocational aspect there right now. You're in terms of the fight for press freedom, in terms of that whole question of how the press operates in these situations. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that in the context of, you know, what we've been trying to do in the Institute. You know, you're an Australian working for Al Jazeera, you work for the BBC. How important is it as an Australian or for Australia that we have Australians, have Australian eyes on the world, have Australians reporting these stories, whether it be for our own media organisations or for international organisations?
Look, I think it's absolutely vital. And I think In my view, one of the problems that we have is that our press has become vastly too insular. We've lost our foreign news coverage. We've lost our eyes on the world, partly because, for the very pragmatic reason, that it's expensive. It costs a hell of a lot of money to run bureaus, to cover stories abroad. Secondly, all of the marketing guys keep telling us that people are more interested in local news than they are in foreign news. But the fact is that we live in it's banal to say, it's blindingly obvious, we live in a more connected world, in a more connected time than we have ever done before in any time in human history. And so we have to have people watching for us, bringing an Australian perspective, covering the stories that matter to Australians, looking at the stories in a way and interpreting it in the context of Australian issues. Mm. It's no good reading a story in the New York Times about Islamic extremism when we've got our own problem with it, our own challenges with Islamic extremism that are relevant to us as Australians. And it bothers me enormously that we still have these very serious debates in the public debates about issues like Islamic extremism, like refugees, without ever having serious coverage of those issues in the first place. We're having these discussions blind, as far as I'm concerned. And as much for the sake of our own democracy, as much for the sake of our own public debates, I think we absolutely have to have that kind of coverage. It worries me enormously that we don't. It worries me enormously that the bureaus, the foreign bureaus, the investment in foreign news has been hacked back to such an extent that we're almost deaf and dumb when it comes to foreign news. I understand the reasons, the pragmatic reasons why. The media has never had it so tough at the moment than at the present. But I think that has some very serious and very fundamental problems and presents some very serious challenges to the way that our government works and makes decisions about foreign policy.
I want to ask one last question before we throw it open to the audience. The organisation you work for, Al Jazeera, there probably isn't a more controversial media organisation in the world or has ever been in some senses. There are people that sing its praises for the hugely transformative effect it's said to have had in the Middle East. Others see it as very much an agenda-driven organisation. You've worked for Al Jazeera, albeit Al Jazeera English. What's your perception of the organisation from the inside?
I wouldn't be with Al Jazeera if I believed that it was an agenda-driven organisation. I've never been asked to cover anything with a particular slant. I've never had any editorial direction beyond the standard kind of debates that we all have in newsrooms, that any healthy newsroom has, about whether you know, what's balanced and what's not balanced, the best way to approach a story, and certainly nothing that's ever given me any sense that I'm being directed towards or pushed towards a particular political line or a particular agenda. I joined Al Jazeera because, to my mind, it did foreign news seriously. It had the resources and the appetite to cover stories that no one else had covered. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done. One of the problems, I won't say this is the only problem. There's no doubt that there are some people in Al Jazeera that have very strong political views and those influence the way that coverage works. But that's true of any news organisation. But I think one of the difficulties is that everything is also interpreted through the highly volatile, politicised lens of the Middle East. Let's take our case, for example. Just because I pick up the phone and talk to a Muslim Brotherhood spokesman immediately is going to be seen as an attempt to further the Brotherhood agenda. If I take that hat off and put a BBC hat off and present the same story, it's going to be seen in a completely different light. So inevitably, the politics of the region is going to colour and influence the way that Al Jazeera is seen. As I said, that's not to suggest the organisation doesn't have problems. Every news organisation is criticised, carries some criticism, and Al Jazeera needs to look very carefully at how it manages its editorial policy. But I don't see the kinds I don't see the kinds of conspiracies that some people are alleging.
I'm going to take some questions from the audience. Raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and tell us who you are before you ask your question. So down here first.
Fred Woollard, I'm interested in hearing your views as to why, from an internal Egyptian government perspective, they made the decision to lock up you and your colleagues, and I'm interested as to why eventually they appear to have folded to foreign opinion and let you out.
I am going to preface what I say by just reminding you that we're still on trial, and so there is a limit to what I can discuss publicly. So, I mean, I'll do my best to answer your question, but you need to bear that in mind. I feel, and this goes back to what I was saying a moment ago, I think that I think that the arrest was for a particular political purpose, and that was to send a message to the press. And I think we were targeted because we were politically convenient. I think that the reasons we were released is a much harder one to assess. I don't really understand why, what it was. I don't think that the Egyptian government necessarily caved in the way that you suggest. Certainly not. I mean, I'm not on the trial hasn't gone away. I'm still on very much a part of the process, and so I think that there is a limit to how much the government gave way on this. I've got no particular insight, to be honest with you, beyond the fact that there was. I think the costs of the public outcry became quite heavy.
My name is Venus Kalesi. I'm from the Australian Baha'i community. I just want to first of all start off by honouring your courage and resilience for the ordeal that you've gone through and to be able to stand here on the other end and make a joke about it and share your experiences. So thank you. Some of the work that the Australian Baha'i community does includes, but is not limited to, advocating for the rights of Baha'is who are unfortunately unjustly imprisoned in Iran with baseless accusations, much like yourself, you know, spies, espionage, when really the reality is that they're in prison because of their religion. From your vantage point, being behind bars, to what extent do you feel that international diplomacy and campaigns, attention from the media, helped to contribute towards your release? And also, what more can be done for your colleagues who unfortunately are still sitting in prison?
Our case reveals two interesting things. The first is that public campaigning does work and can have a very significant impact. You know, it's quite clear, as we've just been discussing, that our case that there was an enormous groundswell of support for us. And that's the good news. The bad news is that it took such a massive heft that was so extraordinary. Certainly in the history of journalism, I don't think we've ever seen a campaign quite as intensive and as widespread as the one that supported us. And so, you know, as I said, the good news is that it worked. The bad news is that it took a campaign of that scale to move things. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of interesting lessons. In fact, we were talking about this before we came down today, about the kinds of lessons. I would like to see an academic study of the campaign to try and understand what actually worked, why it worked, and what bits of it are reproducible and which bits are unique to our case. And I guess that's another rather long-winded way of avoiding the second part of your question. I really don't know. Is a short answer. I mean, for the rest of my colleagues, what we need to do is keep up more of what we've been doing. Our case has largely dropped off the front pages, dropped out of the television screens, and for quite good reason. I think people recognise that we have we've slipped we've been allowed to, our case has been allowed to draw. I mean, what people were concerned about was that we were locked up and now we're out, and people seem to think that that's, we're now out of the process. Obviously, the fact that I'm here means that something has worked, and I think people have got other priorities, quite rightly. But as I said, the thing that concerns me is the issue of the principles that we came to represent, and that if we're allowed, if we simply let this go now, it'll repudiate all of those issues that people fought for. I don't think we're going to get back to where we were before. I think that would probably be inappropriate anyway. But we need people to understand, and diplomats and politicians to also understand that we need to finish this off. That if another injustice is done, it would be very difficult. It would send a very negative message.
Cameron Kirker from IAG. My question is, you were talking about Australians having access to overseas news and the like, and the issue I have with that is that you see a lot of accusations thrown thick and fast about propaganda and lies by one side or the other, and I'm just wondering, in your view, from a practical viewpoint, how do you know which sources you can trust, or failing that, should we just keep a very sceptical view of all the sources available to us?
I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're getting at. You mean in terms of...
Just in terms of when you see sort of coverage of various controversial events. I mean, last year was a particularly active one. How do we know which news sources? You've got Al Jazeera, you've got BBC and the like. How do we know... Should we cherry pick? I mean, should we take for granted that certain observers of particular regions are more trustworthy on news in that particular case? Or?
Yeah, I think what you need to do is do what any good journalist would do, and that's ask, you know, the things that you need to be mindful of is it with stories, the basic principles, or is it fair, is it balanced, and is it accurate? Does it fully, fairly represent the views of everyone involved in a particular story? Do you get a balanced representation of what's going on? And is the story factually accurate? Without wanting to get into a much bigger debate about the principles of journalism, I'm happy to go there, but I think this is probably not the appropriate forum. There's no such thing as objective news. And anyone who thinks that they're getting an objective story is either lying through their teeth or just doesn't understand. Everyone has a particular position. We can mitigate that to a certain extent, but you can never get something that's truly objective. What you need to do is at least assess a range of sources, and it starts to become fairly clear which are the ones that tend to be the outliers, which are the sources that consistently drift off into a particular agenda or a particular supporting a particular side. It's not a science. People seem to think that there is, as I said, that they hold on to this idea of objectivity. It's a great myth that's out there, and I think it's one of the most damaging things that we deal with in journalism, the idea that there is such a thing as an objective news service, because people seek this and expect this objective ideal, which simply doesn't exist. And when they see that it isn't objective, and inevitably there is no such thing, they become disillusioned and disappointed. You need to start by understanding that that doesn't exist.
Matthew Abbott from the corporate watchdog ASIC, but this is a personal question, and I'm asking as a former journalist. Your experience in Egypt, has that killed your passion for reporting from dangerous places? Has it made you gun-shy, or do you still have the fire in the belly?
I'm kind of glad that my mum's in Turkey at the moment when I answer this. I'm going to have to see how I feel when it actually comes to making that decision, but I've got no... I want to get back on the road. One of the things that's frustrating me at the moment is that I can't, as long as this trial is ongoing, I can't get out and do what I love doing or do what I want to do. Whether I approach dangerous places as you describe them in any different way, I don't know. I'll have to see how I actually how I respond when it comes to actually making the decisions. But the way I feel at the moment, I'm very excited about getting back to doing what I want to do. You know, the whole business inevitably, when responsible journalists are working in difficult environments, the whole business is very much about managing risk, about assessing risk, about mitigating risk, and deciding where the limits are that you're prepared to go for a particular story. Whether I draw those lines rather more conservatively than I've done in the past is something I'm going to need to see when I actually get into the field, but I'm certainly not want, and I haven't, it hasn't killed my appetite.
But you're never staying at a Marriott hotel again, right?
No. Carlos Zellner from Australian Associated Press, also a dual Latvian Australian national and journalist. I just want to take you away from this slightly. Judging, or based on your own experience over the last period, what are your thoughts on the Australian government's proposal to strip dual nationals of their citizenship, but particularly the point that a minister could have discretion in this regard?
I had a feeling this question might come up. On paper, I guess if you were to look at the very barest bones of my situation, I would be someone who would be a prime candidate to have his nationality stripped. And that points to me to some of the very serious problems that that approach throws up. I think that, I mean, the most fundamental part of our democracy, or one of the most fundamental parts of our democracy, is the rule of law, is judicial oversight. And due process. The whole point, the due process underpins the democracy, underpins the decision-making. To take away judicial oversight and to hand it to a political figure, I think, is a very, very dangerous thing to do. And it concerns me enormously. As I said, I'm a dual national. I'm accused of terrorism charges. If you look at the letter, the specifics of the letter of what the government is trying to do, I would be a prime candidate. I think anyone in this room, most Australians, would recognise that that would probably be inappropriate.
Hello, I'm Gillian Triggs from the Australian Human Rights Commission. Wonderful to hear you and hear of your experience. See this great support in the room. We, amongst many others, of course, made initiatives for you. And one of the things that really impressed me in speaking to our equivalent in Egypt and the ambassador who came to various meetings in Geneva was their mortification that your story and that of many others, of course, impinged on their national pride because they believed in the rule of law. And when I tried to talk to them about what they meant by the rule of law, of course, it was rather different. But my question is, one wants to see countries like this start to rise to the standards of proper judicial process and trial. Did you feel at the end of this that there is hope in the longer term in Egypt, that they really do want to meet these standards of independence and proper judicial process?
Gillian, I would love to be able to answer that because the fact is we're still not at the end of it. How do I put this? I think we've come from a very different tradition, judicial tradition. We've arrived at the position that we have at the moment in Australia from a very, very, from a completely different judicial history. And it's been a long and not always smooth process to get us to this stage. Egypt is very fresh in its democracy and its judicial, the principles of judicial oversight. And I think that it's, we need to recognise that it's very much a work in progress. I think in general terms, what I would say is that Egypt, I think, is going through the process of learning the relationship between the rule of law and respect for the rule of law and the way that a government can and should work and the risks of blurring that distinction. Now, I know this is probably talking in very elliptical terms, but I hope you'll understand the situation that I'm in at the moment. I think that, as I said, I think very much for them this is a work in progress, and there are a lot of lessons to be learned.
Peter, it's been great to have you here for this hour, to learn a bit more about the personal side of what you went through. All of us admired your great dignity and great integrity that you've shown through the whole process, and that of your family as well, including your parents. It's great that you're out, but you're not quite out yet, and we hope you the best. Hope the best for your future, and that we hope that those legal issues are finally resolved, and you can go back on the beat to countries, including countries that have extradition treaties with Egypt.
Thank you.
Please join me again in thanking Peter Greston. See you all next time.